Hey everybody, welcome to episode 18 of the 2QB Experience. This is the Sam Bradford Experience. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Greg Smith, at Greg Suss on Twitter. Your other host is also on the line. His name is Joshua Lake, and you can find him on Twitter at Lake2QBs. Josh, what's up, my man?
Hey, doing well. Enjoyed seeing some semi-real football this weekend with week three of the preseason and not loving the injuries that we've been seeing over the last couple of days.
Yeah, we're going to get to some of those in just a bit. But, you know, we're kind of in the heart of draft season right now. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how your drafts have been going. I'm sure you've drafted most of your leagues, if not all of them.
Yep, one left to work league on Labor Day. That's it.
Okay. And I'm wondering, like, Who are the players that you found yourself drafting the most now that, you know, we're beyond the mock drafts and we're into, you know, real drafts?
Guys that I have a lot of, Kirk Cousins, because I'm higher on him than a lot of people are, so he ends up as my quarterback a lot. Stephon Diggs, although we'll get to the Teddy Bridgewater news that hurts, but I liked Stephon Diggs as kind of a breakout value candidate this year. Giovanni Bernard, if there's any sort of half or full PPR, is another guy I like. Those are some of the names that end up on several of my teams. Those are the ones I really like. There's probably some names I'd rather have not drafted, but those are the guys I really like. What about you?
Yeah, Bernard is one for me as well. I've been targeting him like crazy, mostly in PPR formats as well, although I did just recently take him in an auction that is non-PPR, but it's a 14-teamer, so you kind of just want anybody who's going to get a lot of touches in that sort of format. I've ended up with a lot of Jordan Matthews and Michael Crabtree. And we'll get to more on Matthews when we talk about Bradford later, but Crabtree's a guy I don't understand why he's ranked so low everywhere when, you know, who the hell else are they going to throw to? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah, they didn't really change the offense. Nothing says they're going to have lower volume. He seems like he's in line for exactly the same year.
Yeah, I have a lot of Jerick McKinnon shares, which kind of I can piggyback off of your Stephon Diggs shame at this point with that, because it's like, who knows what that offense is going to be like now. Maybe they will just run like 40 times a game with McKinnon and AP, you know, fingers crossed for me, right?
Yeah, and maybe that extra wear and tear makes it harder for AP to get through the year. I mean, you don't wish for that, but there's a narrative where McKinnon becomes real interesting.
Sure, yeah. Now, are there any guys who, you know, you really like that maybe you didn't get as many shares of as you would have wanted?
Philip Rivers, for sure. I don't know that I own him in any redraft league this year, which is sad. I like him a whole lot, but seems like the rest of the world kind of does as well.
Yeah, that's at QB for me. Rivers is one of those guys. But I mean, you know me when it comes to quarterbacks. I don't really care who I draft. For me, it's more like the wide receivers and the running backs. I've kind of come around on Melvin Gordon, as strange as that is. I guess we're going to keep talking about the Chargers, but he is a guy who, like, the more I kind of look at that offense, the more, you know, we factor in those, again, potential narratives of an improved offensive line, a bounce back from Rivers and Keenan Allen. Like, it really seems like Gordon is undervalued, but it seems like everyone realized he was undervalued and drafted him appropriately. What do you think about Gordon?
Yeah, I agree. He's a name that I've liked and I've had in quite a few NFL 10s over the early offseason, but he got a little more attention. I just think as people realize there really isn't any competition. I mean, now Brandon Oliver blew out his Achilles, and so there's even less competition. Not that it was a true competition, but just it's clear that Melvin Gordon is going to be the one running the ball. Woodhead is still very involved, but he's not the carry threat. And so the volume, I think people started recognizing that whether he's good or bad, you at least are going to get carries.
The other guy I was hoping to end up with more shares of was Le'Veon Bell. I thought that, you know, with the suspension, even after it got reduced, that, you know, his price would still be suppressed to a point where you might be able to get him into the third round occasionally. And that just wasn't the case. Like, he was always a second round pick or a first round pick, and I didn't really get him anywhere. I was kind of bummed about that because I do really want him on my teams. And I think I can draft in a way that makes up for the fact that he's going to miss the games. But again, it seems like other drafters have the same mentality.
Yeah, I think I mentioned last time that I ended up with him in my home league and ended up paying, I believe I paid $33 out of a $200 budget. And so it was a somewhat of a discount off of our top running backs in that league, but not a huge one, just because, like you said, people really haven't discounted him as much as maybe we thought they could have.
Yeah, man, speaking of auction values, in that league that I drafted last night, that auction where I ended up with Diggs. Did I mention that I ended up with Diggs? I don't remember. Anyway, the values on the ESPN auction client were absurd. They had guys ranked up into the $80 and $70 ranges.
Geez. So did it fall off very quickly?
It did. So, like, you, if you wanted anybody who was nominated early, you had to spend a lot because, you know, people, whether they like it or not, they look at those numbers and they think they matter, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, I had my own set of auction values that I set up before the draft, and I'm looking at where I have these top end guys ranked, maybe as high as, say, like $60, but ESPN has the same guys like Antonio Brown up in the 70 to 80 range. And it's like, well, if I want any of these guys, I either have to wait and try to draft the very last, you know, one or two of them available when everyone else has run out of money, or I have to pay, you know, top dollar. And so it became this weird kind of guessing game where you had to get in on players when it seemed like they were being undervalued by the room, not necessarily by the software itself. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with some guys that, you know, I think maybe other people don't like as much, or they were the guys that were in tiers with other guys that people generally like more. So one example that comes to mind is that kind of second tier of running backs where you have Devonta Freeman, Doug Martin, Le'Veon Bell, maybe you want to lump him in there. And I ended up getting Doug Martin for, you know, what felt like a lot to me, but compared to his price on there and compared to what people were paying for, you know, that similar tier of running back, it wasn't quite as much. And it was a very strange draft. And I wonder why ESPN did that, because it was clear that the total amount of, you know, dollars allotted to the players didn't come close to being like the amount of money that was in the room, even with 14 teams.
Yeah, I haven't experienced that. Because we did the mock for two QBs on ESPN, but I haven't had an auction online in a while through ESPN. I guess what you were saying just brings to mind the anchoring effect, which is just a psychological truth that the first value we as humans see kind of sets what we're going to do off of it. So we may still say, oh, that $80 is too high. But in that format, people may pay 70 or 75, whereas if you didn't give them those values and you said 50 is the appropriate number, they might go 55. And so just what you see in front of you really has a subconscious effect on what you're willing to bid.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And the one thing I will give ESPN credit for in terms of how they assigned those values was it was a one quarterback league, and they definitely devalued the quarterbacks relative to the other positions. Some of the elite guys were only, you know, slotted for, say, $20, when those elite wide receivers and running backs, as I mentioned before, were really, really high priced. But yeah, interesting. And I have a feeling it has to do with, you know, ESPN looking at the draft setup or the league setup and trying to, you know, calculate values based upon that. But I don't think it did a very good job in that particular league. But who knows? I mean, maybe they didn't, and I just was drafting improperly. I have no idea. Anyway, let's get on to some new stuff at 2QBs.com. A lot of big news lately. And let's start off on, you know, the unfortunate notes on the injuries and the cuts, the first of which was one that's fresh today. Our recording on Tuesday, Teddy Bridgewater suffered a very seemingly major and very scary injury, non-contact in practice.
Taken off by ambulance, torn ACL, structural damage. I mean, just terrible. This apparently teammates were cursing, slamming their helmets down. They called practice off. Like, just sounds horrendous.
Yeah, and then while that's a really, really sad story, as fantasy owners, especially in 2QB leagues, we have to try to think about the implications of this with regards to our leagues. And I know it's not fun to do that. I know it's not necessarily appropriate to, you know, look at Teddy Bridgewater's horrendous injury as an opportunity to gain value in a fantasy league, because what the hell does this really matter? We're talking about a dude's career and a dude's mobility. That sucks for him. But Sal did write a piece about Joel Stave, who is the backup to Sean Hill. And, you know, Sean Hill has become the default starter there in Minnesota. I'm not so curious about the quarterbacks. I think we know what Sean Hill is. I don't think Joel Stave is going to see the light of day in a real NFL game unless Sean Hill completely combusts. But what does this do to your outlook on the other Vikings players? We briefly mentioned before Stephon Diggs and Jerick McKinnon, but where are you at on the Vikings offense now that Bridgewater appears to be out for a long time?
It doesn't change a ton because it was already going to be a low pass volume offense. I think Sean Hill, if he ends up being the starter, will be fine, but not inspiring. And so it's still kind of the same. You may like Diggs, but he probably isn't going to be a world beater with Hill throwing to him. If they bring in someone, like, there are all sorts of speculation, Mark Sanchez, Geno Smith, Colin Kaepernick, Josh McCown. There's so many different directions this team could go. But at the end of the day, I think they probably, if they have someone new or even Sean Hill who knows the offense but isn't thought of as an exceptional quarterback, I would expect they're still going low volume. So I don't know that I'm going to be very thrilled with any of their receiving options. I had hoped Teddy was going to take a step forward and maybe they up their volume a little, but I don't see any way they do that with a brand new quarterback they hadn't planned on starting.
Yeah, you and me both. I was targeting Diggs in my drafts. I liked him in that kind of mid to late section of the draftable wide receivers. I'd even started to dip my toes in the Charles Johnson waters because I liked him a lot last year. He had a terrible 2015, but it came out after the season that maybe that was injury related. He broke some ribs early in the year and tried to play through it. So that might explain why he was so disappointing last year. And you know, based upon what we were hearing out of camp and what we were seeing in the preseason, it really did seem like maybe he was a guy who might be a post-hype sleeper. And all that stuff is just kind of out the window for me now. I'm with you. I don't think the pass catchers have a whole lot of appeal. I think that Adrian Peterson either stays put in the rankings or maybe even moves up a little bit. I agree with what you mentioned earlier about McKinnon maybe being an even better play now that Peterson has that projected extra volume just to keep the ball out of the quarterback's hands. And the other guy who I think does move up a little bit is Kyle Rudolph, just as, you know, that kind of safety valve, that check down option for Sean Hill or whoever ends up being quarterback. Any other thoughts on the Vikings and Bridgewater before we keep going here?
No, I like that final point about Rudolph, just that I would expect that a less experienced quarterback that maybe is being told to kind of rein things in could definitely be looking at the tight end more, kind of those short underneath routes. So that's an interesting call if you're really waiting on tight end.
Yeah, and if they're running the ball more and, you know, Rudolph is in there to block, you know, a little more occasionally, that does make him a better threat to maybe catch some defenses off guard in the receiving game. But the next piece we want to talk about is another backup quarterback profile by Sal, Mike Bercovici, who is what he calls it. And it's looking at the guy right there in the title, Mike Bercovici, who is stepping in behind your boy, Phil Rivers, now that Zach Bettenberger has been cut. Do we care about him in two quarterback drafts?
I don't. And Sal just continues to pull names out of a hat, but he's been right so many times. It makes me hesitant to say no. Rivers is pretty consistent. He is certainly not at any sort of increased injury risk over any other quarterback. So I would say we're interested in the same way we're interested in any backup quarterback, but I don't see a lot to make me think this one is more likely than any others to be valuable.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's more of a just a potential thought to store away for the waiver wire later in the year in case Rivers does get hurt. Now, speaking of injuries, we're back to another QB who is going to miss significant time, Tony Romo. That news broke since our last podcast. He's going to be out for most of the year, or at least half the year, it seems. Dak Prescott, suddenly fantasy relevant right out of the gate. Did we curse Tony Romo in episode 6?
Ugh. Apparently we have some sort of effect at this point.
Now, we talked a lot about that in that episode, right? About the fragility of Tony Romo.
Right, and just guessing how many games he'd make it through.
Yeah, I feel a little dirty. I do not like this feeling because I really do like Tony Romo. Like, we were talking about shares of guys that we have earlier, and if you look through all the different drafts I did, including all the mock drafts we've been doing at 2QBs.com, I have more shares of Romo than any other quarterback across those leagues. And so, I mean, I was a believer. I still am a believer. I think he's a good quarterback, but the dude just can't stay on the field.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any medical truth to it, but you just wonder if he's got like brittle bones or something at this point. I mean, the hit didn't look like anything spectacular. It looked like a hit that could have occurred to any other quarterback. And just all of these broken bones add up after a while. And it certainly worries you. Even if he comes back, will he rush back? Will he get hurt again? Definitely worries you. I don't know that you can really stash him in most formats, even 2QB leagues, just because right now it could be 10 weeks before he plays.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you'd be willing to draft him at all. And I'm with you. I am kind of just staying away altogether. Now, I do expect him to come back at some point. I'm just not sure if when he does come back, we can expect him to stay healthy even then. It just doesn't seem like he's got it in him anymore. I mean, I wish him the best and I hope I'm wrong. Let's put it that way. Anyway, next up, let's get to some positive news. Let's talk about Drew Brees and a profile that was written on him by James Simpson. And James basically lays out the cases of Drew Brees's, you know, just fantasy dominance over the past however many years. He's really laid out a good picture of what has made Drew Brees so good. Josh, have you been drafting Drew Brees at all?
I don't think I have him in any redraft leagues. I have a lot of him in MFL 10s because I think he was in that sweet spot of coming after the elite guys by a fairly significant amount and still having possibility of being right there with them at season's end. But kind of your influence rubbing off on me. I've waited longer at quarterback in all my redraft leagues, so I haven't taken anyone in the top five, I don't believe.
You have been infected, my friend. Yes. Let's keep going. Next up, Josh Hornsby has recently released his first set of projections for the quarterback position and for, you know, offenses in general. He looked at the AFC and the NFC North divisions, and those are going to have to get updated for this Teddy Bridgewater news, but the projections are super in-depth. They are awesome. Josh did an excellent job, and I encourage everyone to check that out. That's all I'm going to say about that, unless you have any notes on those two particular divisions, Mr. Lake.
Just that, absolutely encourage you to check it out. It's something that we couldn't do justice if we tried to summarize. It really is a quite unique in the world of fantasy look at projecting what these seasons will look like. Would highly commend reading it.
Yep. The last up is a piece that I wrote a little while ago. I called it Sensory Fantasy Football, and this is kind of an idea that I came up with as I was walking my dog. I feel like, you know, as human beings, we tend to do some of our best thinking when we're not quite engaged with, you know, active thinking, you know what I mean? Like walking the dog, mm-hmm. taking a shower, things like that. And the general gist is about, you know, these senses for fantasy football that you have, like when you read a bit of news, like how it makes you feel, how you, your brain interprets that. And I won't, you know, go too in depth into the piece because it's kind of think PC in the first place, but I do want to use this as kind of a jumping off point to talk about our main topic. And I'm calling this accepting the merits of different draft strategies. And my general point is this, that every potential draft strategy has some amount of merit. There are pros and there are cons, right? And too often I think that we focus on, you know, trying to figure out what the one best draft strategy is. And I don't think that you can ever answer that before a draft happens. You know, every pick that's made affects the way that draft plays out in a different way. And as soon as one person does something that you couldn't predict or didn't predict, that changes the whole landscape and you have to be able to adjust for that. So having, you know, a cookie cutter strategy that says, okay, I'm going to draft a wide receiver, then a wide receiver, then a quarterback, then a running back, like that just doesn't work because you're not in it. You're not in the moment when you're making that decision pre-draft. Josh, I kind of want to kick it over to you for some thoughts on this.
No, I think it's a very good point that any of these strategies can work. And both you and I, along with Sal and some other folks, have been helping some folks draft through Draft Day Consultants. And I think it's been one of the helpful things just to talk through and kind of explain philosophy on how to draft is breaking down these big picture strategies. And rather than just using it as kind of a mantra and saying, I am doing this strategy, really think through why you would do it, why not to do it, and really get to the reasoning that underlies it. Because it is easy for us to just say, well, I'm sticking to this. Whatever happens, this is what I'm doing on draft day.
Yeah, and I mean, we talk about this a lot on the site. We have these three basic archetypes of 2QB drafting that Sal has come up with, and they're very good guides to, you know, default strategies you can take going into your draft. He has the example of, you know, quarterback to start your draft, or studs and streaming where you take one quarterback early and then you take two or three later. Or there's just the late round quarterback stuff where you wait as long as possible to take all of your quarterbacks. And I've been thinking about LRQB in general, and I think that the idea of or the title of late round quarterback in 2QB leagues isn't quite adequate for the way I want to, you know, kind of pass along that information. I like to think of it as more, you know, like lower tier quarterback drafting, you know, looking at the fact that those lower tier guys are still usable and taking advantage of that. Now, because we do get a lot of pushback, we've talked about this, where, you know, certain people say, well, quarterbacks go early in my draft anyway, I can't wait that long. So it's not about late round, it's just about not caring about getting the best guys, as a lot of people do. But the point is that there are pros and cons to all of them. You have to look at both sides. And yeah, I mean, if you pick the right players in any sort of strategy, you can win. And if you apply your, you know, strategy of choice in a smart way and you get the, you know, the adequate dose of luck that is involved in fantasy football, these things can really pay off for you. It's just a matter of executing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true and worth remembering that there is so much luck that goes into all of this that picking players, like you said, if you pick the right players, you win every time. And so not being so attached to a strategy, because the strategy can be good or bad. One of the things I wrote about early in the offseason, kind of during our site's infancy, was that you should really know your personal strengths and know what you are good at drafting, know what you are good at finding on the waiver wire, know the positions you don't evaluate very well, and kind of use that to your advantage as well, because a strategy that works for some owners may not work for you personally if you just aren't good at executing that during the season. Like, for instance, if you are thinking you're going to go late at quarterback, kind of stream the position, but you historically don't pick good, like you don't have Sal's touch at finding the good backup quarterbacks, and you don't stream quarterbacks well, then maybe you don't trust yourself with a late quarterback strategy, and that's personal to you rather than saying the strategy doesn't work.
Yeah, for sure. And in addition to all of that, I mean, just the way your league is set up can make certain fantasy analysis or certain draft strategy analysis kind of moot, you know? Like, if your league is set up in such a way that it destroys, you know, the idea of zero RB or studs and streaming, then you kind of have to throw that default idea out of the window and figure out how to attack your draft. So I think there's a lot more value in kind of looking at each league, and not just each league, but each pick in your draft on a case-by-case basis. If you try to decide this stuff ahead of time, you're really doing yourself a disservice. I think when it comes to these league settings, the Scott Fishbowl was a great example. Like, we saw a lot of interesting debate about what was the best way to go in that sort of draft, because you could take it in so many different directions.
It is always fun to see a league that's kind of outside the norm, and just because it does make you reevaluate and think through things in a unique way.
Well, and I think in addition to that, playing in a variety of, you know, league settings makes you a better player overall. You know, if you're used to being able to adapt in the moment on the fly, because you've drafted, you know, a different league type every week of August, you know, that in and of itself gives you a little bit better. It gives you a better opportunity to make, you know, the correct flexible decision, or to flex in the right way for a league type that maybe you are more familiar with. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it is important to have, you know, a good default strategy. Like, that's what draft prep is all about. Like, you look at your league settings, you look at the players you like, you try to figure out, okay, what's the way I want to attack this draft? I think that is crucial. I think that you have to do that. But knowing when to properly deviate from that default strategy is how you gain your biggest edges. You know, that's the, you know, the zigging when others zag thing that people talk about all the time. Like, having that good default strategy gives you advantages over, like, the, you know, the less experienced players, the fish in your league, whereas knowing when you can deviate appropriately is what gives you advantages, or at least gives you equity with the sharks, the people who really know what they're doing as well.
Yeah, and I think that step is not often talked about, and I am guilty of not going into a draft with thinking through when will I deviate from that strategy, but putting the time and effort into that, not just coming up with your strategy, but then thinking through kind of the flow chart I think we've talked about before of what conditions are going to set you down a different path, and just being ready for that so that you are a little more prepared to adapt on the fly.
Yeah, like that auction league I was in last night, the 14 team one quarterback league, I, you know, told myself going in I'm going to spend the minimum on tight end and quarterback. I'm going to spend $1 on each. But, you know, I'm like most other drafters in an auction. I'll start bidding guys up in the low dollar amounts if I think that they're severely underpriced. And, you know, Drew Brees is getting bid up, and I make a bid of $9 on Drew Brees in a one quarterback league, but it's 14 teams. So if I have a good quarterback, that's nice. And sure enough, no one takes the bait. No one bids him up to 10. And it's like, well, there goes my plan of not drafting or not spending a lot on a quarterback, but I didn't spend a lot. I spent a lot less than what I think he's worth. So that works for me, you know, and I can process that information. I can take that element of my draft to that point and let it affect and inform my decisions going forward from there. Yeah, anyway, I just think the catch-all strategy is, if you tell yourself you're going to draft zero RB or studs and streaming or even late-round quarterback, which I advocate for all the time, if you go into a draft with a hard-line mentality like that, that's wrong. That's a trap. You're just doing yourself a disservice because you're not giving yourself flexibility. Like, I think as an industry, we're much too quick to seek out that shortcut, the one that, you know, tells you, oh, I'm going to win my league 75% of the time if I do X, because that's not how fantasy football works. Like, if you are right 55% of the time, you're probably doing a good job, right? And to think that, you know, any hardline strategy without context is going to do that for you, I don't think you can get there. And Josh, I'm going to keep ranting, so stay quiet.
No, it's good stuff. I mean, I think this is important for people to think through.
Yeah, I mean, I just think the thing that we don't impart to drafters often enough is that you need to apply, like, these big picture questions like running back versus wide receiver to each pick in your draft on a granular level. Like, you need to wait until you're on the clock. You need to look at everything that's available, plus everything that's already happened, and figure out what the right move is right then at that moment. And that's a ton of information to process. Like, our brains are very, very powerful, but you know, you have to teach them to do this. You have to like let them learn how to make those decisions without even realizing why they're making the decision sometimes. Like there's that element of instinct. There's that element of, you know, muscle memory of practice that only comes by playing more, by being in more leagues, by trying different formats, like I talked about earlier. I just think that all these, you know, cookie cutter draft strategies, they have pros, they have cons, but winning is about trying to understand both sides of all the different strategies, right? Taking a look at strategy X and looking at the pros and cons of that, and then strategy Y and doing the same thing. And then you have to kind of boil that all up into one big stew and figure out, you know, the specific risks associated with the angles that you're going to take. And sometimes you want to take a riskier angle because, you know, that gives you a higher chance of, you know, winning outright. You know, maybe you could take the hedgy play and that might get you to that, you know, 54% win rate. But, you know, other ones might give you a 50% win rate, but a, you know, a 60% win rate of winning big, you know, of really dominating your league. And you have to kind of make those choices for yourself and figure out what works for you.
Yeah, no, I like it. I think that too little time is spent on draft strategy writ large and too much is spent on specific players when, like you said, the best accuracy folks in the game are at that 60% mark maybe when it comes to rankings. And so I think we could do to spend a little less time on specific player evaluation and a little more on big picture draft strategy. Not that player evaluation is unimportant, but just it is covered so well and so thoroughly and just so much time is spent on it that thinking through kind of those big picture, like you said, what angle you want to take, how you want to approach drafts, like that is time well spent.
Well, Josh, I hate to tell you, but we're going to have to do some player-specific analysis here. We've got Sam Bradford as our QB spotlight for the week. And, you know, let's start it off, as we always do in this segment, with a prediction of the number of top 20 weeks that Bradford will post this season.
Top 20 weeks this season, I am going to say he has, I'm going to say 9.
Yeah. This is so hard. Like, how do you evaluate Sam Bradford? We just haven't seen him. Like, there's just so much new with this team, right? New coach, new personnel. Like, I don't know. Like, 9 seems low to me almost, but that was the number that popped into my head as well. I'll take the over. I'll say 10, but I'm right there with you. I don't think it makes a big difference. Now, of those top 20 weeks, how many do you think are going to be top 10?
I'd say very few. 1, 2, like I am very pessimistic about the upside here.
He had 3 in 14 games last year. Does that change your mind?
I just don't think that Doug Peterson and Chip Kelly's offenses are going to look similar enough. I'd say 1.5, but to hedge, I'll say 2.
So 1 top 10 week and 1 top 15 week. Is that what you're saying?
Something like that.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to go higher. I'm going to take 3. I'm going to say he matches last year's total. He has more games to do it, assuming that he can start 16, which is not a foregone conclusion, I'll admit. But he does play in a pretty soft division. I think that, you know, hopefully those opponents there in the NFC East will gift him a couple of good performances, and maybe he can pick up one more along the way. I have a feeling we might be undervaluing Bradford a little bit as a community, but there's just really not that much to get excited about. And I say that, but he did just have a really good preseason performance. It kind of cemented him as the starter above Chase Daniel, above Carson Wentz on the Eagles depth chart. Are you moving him up in your ranks based upon, you know, that presumed safety?
A little bit, just because it does look like he's going to get more starts than it seemed. And I have been pleasantly surprised with the preseason action I've seen. I think that there is more potential than I was giving the offense, not the huge upside, but I do think he'll have more top 20 finishes than I was originally expecting.
Yeah, me too. I moved him up a couple spots in my rankings. I think he's still like QB 28 for me, which isn't, you know, a ringing endorsement, but I think that he should be okay. And if he's your QB 3 or your QB 4 in, say, a 10-team league, I think you can be comfortable enough with that, especially if your starters are solid. If you're only really depending upon him for a handful of weeks, either when the matchups are good or when your other guys are on bye, I think Bradford will probably, you know, cut the mustard and give you that 10 to 15 fantasy points that you want from a backup QB. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like your schedule point that I think maybe it's just some bias, but I think the Redskins secondary will be improved, but I do still think the 6 games they play against the East are relatively easy as far as your in-division schedule goes. So, and their out-of-division schedule isn't terrible either. So just matchup alone says that Bradford could have a decent season. Like you said, as kind of a low-end quarterback.
Yeah, now we mentioned a little bit, like, kind of feeling better about his job security. I think we both do, but how much, on, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much are you worried that he'll still lose his job to Chase Daniel or Carson Wentz?
I am much less than I was before. I think Daniel is still a threat. I think they would have to be a real dumpster fire for Carson Wentz to get significant time this year, just because I expect this division will stay close like it did the last few years. It'll stay close pretty late, and I don't think they turn away from the veterans to Wentz if they are still a reasonably competitive team. Daniel maybe, but I am less convinced that the team turns to Daniel just from the way they've approached Bradford this offseason. I was originally super concerned that just the relationship was so bad, that Bradford wanted out, that the new team brought in Daniel that was Peterson's guy, but it really hasn't seemed that time has kind of borne out that theory.
Yeah, that relationship between Daniel and Peterson is what gives me the most pause with regard to Bradford. Like, I think that Bradford has been good enough, you know, and the reports that we're hearing out of camp back that up, that, you know, he will be the starter. They expect him to start most, if not all, the games this year, if healthy. But I don't know. I think that there's probably a reason they brought in Chase Daniel. And I think they had to know they were going to draft a quarterback, too. So I am not quite ready to fully endorse Bradford as this guy who's, you know, untouchable in that offense. And I don't think you're saying that either, but I do still have some concerns that Chase Daniel could take over at some point. And again, I'm not drafting Chase Daniel, but he is another one, like, you know, Mike Berkovici or whoever else, that you need to know his name if you're in a 2QB league, because if Bradford does get hurt, or you know, if it's reported midweek, you know, when you have open free agency on players, that, you know, Bradford's not going to play in a game, you need to be able to rush to your wire and type in Daniel's name faster than your opponents. Now, you know, hopefully most of your leagues have waivers that prevent that stuff from happening, but that's a separate discussion.
Fair point.
So what do you think of the rest of this offense, Josh? I mean, Bradford has looked better. What does that do for the other guys on the Eagles?
I think right now Jordan Matthews is looking stronger and stronger and stronger to me. As the offense is better, that helps, but also just it doesn't seem like anyone is really stepping up to be any sort of threat to steal market share from him.
Are you saying you don't believe in David Watford?
Who's that? Sounds like a Baywatch character.
Or Marcus Johnson?
Sounds like a sprinter.
Or Josh Huff? Well, you know who Josh Huff is.
Josh Huff is Chip Kelly's good friend.
But I mean, these receivers, yeah, aside from Matthews, they're bad, aren't they? Like, who do you trust?
Such a bad depth chart. I mean, even at the top end, Nelson Agholor is currently listed as a starter for the Eagles and just didn't look good. Talk has not been good. He hasn't shown anything special this offseason. And he's a starter on the team. I mean, it is looking rough. And then just like you said, the names that no one knows beyond those starters.
Yeah, I mean, DGB just got traded to the Eagles. Doriel Green Beckham, I should probably say his whole name. But I don't know. Like, you have to think that he's going to get involved at least in some capacity here, because these other names on the depth chart are just, I mean, I have no faith in any of them. I've never heard of half of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scary thing. If you think if Jordan Matthews goes down, this could really crater. Just the pass offense could struggle mightily, and it might still. Maybe Jordan Matthews isn't enough of a wide receiver one to really elevate the offense, but the depth chart is pretty shaky at that position, and I hope that DGB becomes good. He has the athleticism and kind of the raw talent to be really special.
But does he have it between the ears?
Right, that's the thing. And are you banking on him? I mean, this depth chart just really would worry me if I was going to invest much in the quarterback. Thankfully, it's Sam Bradford, and so none of us is rushing out to invest in him. But the weapons around him don't help.
Yeah, I have been drafting Matthews a lot in the mocks and in a couple leagues. And I think that he is just kind of one of those guys just by default is going to be usable based on the volume that he should get, considering these other wide receivers. One guy we haven't talked about yet is Zach Ertz. Now, he's probably, you know, the wide receiver one or wide receiver two if you kind of eschew positions altogether and just look at these guys as receivers altogether. What do you think about Ertz this year? I was kind of cold on him, but, you know, looking at the way this team is shaken out, I should probably start, you know, giving him a little bit more credence in my drafts.
Yeah, Ertz is a guy that's been a name, like he's been an intriguing name for quite a while now, and he just really hasn't ever put up a season that would merit it. He needs to be a lot more involved in the red zone. I am worried with what Peterson did with Travis Kelce, who was a really interesting name and still is, just because he would have such hot and cold weeks where he'd disappear from the game plan entirely. And so Ertz is intriguing to me, but I am not going out. I don't think I own him in any league at this point, just because there are so many tight ends that are interesting, and I think there's many more with red zone opportunities.
You raise a good point with regards to how Peterson used Kelce last season, and this Eagles roster is kind of similar to that Chiefs team in that way, where they only really have one wide receiver that we trust, you know, Macklin compared to Jordan Matthews, and then the tight end is kind of the second receiving option by default. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how things go. If things do play out like the Chiefs did, that could mean a lot for the running backs. And that kind of makes a lot of sense when you look at the way this roster is constructed. They have not only Ryan Matthews, who should be, you know, getting the bulk of the handoffs, but they also have Darren Sproles, Wendell Smallwood, and Kenyon Barner, all guys who are good out of the backfield as receivers. So are we sleeping on those guys a little bit too much? Do we need to assign more value to the pass catching receiving backs for the Eagles?
I think so. I like Ryan Matthews. It's surprising to me that he is drafted as low as he is. Sproles is the one that's really mind-boggling, though, because he goes undrafted or at the bottom of a lot of PPR drafts, and I think there's still a very clear role here, and think he's going to be a very useful guy where you can wait on running back and plug him in as a starter if you need to.
Yeah, I don't think you can look at any of those guys outside of PPR formats, but I do agree that we're probably undervaluing one or all of them. And my main concern, and the real reason I don't tend to draft those guys, is because there are three of them. And I know that Barner's, you know, not a guy we really need to pay attention to for the most part. Like, we know what he is. He's kind of a backup forever, one of those guys. But Sproles and you know, the upside of Smallwood, like, one of those guys could really break out. My concern is that it might be hard to figure out which one it is. And so those are the types of situations that I tend to avoid in drafts. Josh, do you have anything else on Bradford or the Eagles before we wrap this thing up?
I will just say that, to the point earlier about moving him up, he is getting closer to that boring backup, fantasy backup role that I like. He's not there, but I'm not as devastated if he's my QB3 as I would have been earlier in the offseason. There is some potential there, more than I'd given him credit for.
So on that note, we have a little bit of time here. Let's talk about some of the other quarterbacks that are kind of going in that range. I'm assuming you're drafting Bradford over Trevor Siemian, over Blaine Gabbert, correct?
Yes.
You'd probably draft him over Sean Hill as well at this point?
Yes.
Okay, what about Jay Cutler?
No, definitely not.
Okay. How about Brock Osweiler?
No, I don't think I would do that, just because the upside is there with Osweiler, and it's not, in my opinion, with Bradford.
Do you have any hot takes on, you know, other QBs that I haven't mentioned here that maybe you could see Bradford outscoring? Like, would you be surprised if Sam Bradford outscored Alex Smith this year?
I would be surprised. I think Alex Smith is incredibly reliable. I don't think that Bradford has that in him, just because there's so many risks.
Okay, fair enough.
I think it would take Smith missing games and Bradford playing 16 for it to happen.
So Alex Smith is kind of like the most boring quarterback alive. So for you to say that, you know, Sam Bradford is even more boring than that, that sounds about right to me. I can get on board with that.
Yeah, I think he is right there in that bad, boring combination of, you could probably plug him in and play him, but you're not going to be very happy about it.
Yep, and I do think there still needs to be that faint worry about him getting benched at some point. That could happen, especially if the team does fall off a cliff. But we've talked enough about Bradford. Let's wind the show down here. I mean, unless you got any final thoughts, Josh.
No, I think it's about that time.
As always, we will urge you, the listeners, to rate and review the podcast. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. I looked into getting us up on SoundCloud because some people had requested that. But unless we use SoundCloud as our primary upload source, it just doesn't work out that well. And we're already, you know, loyal Podbean podcasters. So sorry, SoundCloud folks, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Please follow 2QBs on Twitter at TWOQBS. Of course, check out the site 2QBs.com, spelled the same way. Follow Josh on Twitter at Lake2QBs. You can follow me at GregSauce. Search us up on Facebook. Give us a like on there. We'd appreciate it. And for anything that can't be taken care of through those social media outlets, 2QBs@gmail.com. Spell it out. TWOQBS, just like everywhere else. Thank you all for listening. We will catch you next week. Or I shouldn't say we. Oh, programming alert. This just in. This is my last show for a couple weeks. I'm taking a vacation. Josh will be taking over primary hosting duties with a couple of very cool guests. So stay tuned for that. And they will catch you next time on the 2QB Experience. Adios.